Mike Riley back with us, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, specializes in insurance kinds of issues. And Mike, good to see you.
Great to see you, Larry.
And Guy DeBow with us as well. Guy is a healthcare attorney and also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Guy, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
You can join in with your questions as we talk auto insurance. We can talk about roundabouts and some of the laws regarding roundabouts. We can talk about the issues surrounding medical marijuana. So lots of legal things we can deal with at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And first, I was going to go to both you guys first for a minute. Mike, you've been with us in the past, but just as a reminder, talk a bit about what areas that you typically cover.
Sure. The focus of my practice is personal injuries, so I represent people who've been injured in accidents of various kinds, mostly car accidents. I also do a lot of work on insurance coverage, so I spend quite a lot of time on dealing with issues concerning coverage, what coverage people have. And I guess one of the things I want to talk about today is what coverage people should have that they don't.
Yeah. And Guy DeBow, what about you?
Well, I have been for about the past 25 years doing work with the healthcare field and all sorts of related topics to that. More recently, because of an overlap coming from CBD laws, I've developed an interest in the cannabis laws, the regulations. As you probably know, there's a new hemp pilot program that's taken off in the state. We've recently had referenda in that area. So there's a lot of stuff going on in that space that we've grown interested in.
Well, Jerry in Milwaukee already has a question for you, so let's go there. Jerry, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. I'm calling in reference to automobile insurance.
Yep.
I have a car that's about 20 years old, and it runs like a new car. I'm a safe driver. I've never had a ticket other than parking tickets in my life. I've been driving since I was 14 years old. I'm now in my 60s. My question to you is, I've heard so many do's and don'ts in terms of what coverage I should have. For instance, collision, yes, no, the amounts. You know, I like good coverage, but what should I have?
Jerry, you asked the perfect first question here, I think. Mike, go ahead.
It's a great question, Jerry. I mean, really, with a car that age, you know, I know that it has great sentimental value and really good value because it runs well, which is wonderful. Really, to pay premiums for collision or comprehensive, you know, the coverages that protect you from damage to your car probably doesn't make a great deal of sense. It's always a trade-off. You look at what the premium is. You look at what it would cost you to replace the car, which in one sense is irreplaceable. But, you know, if you had to go out and buy something of similar vintage, it's not going to cost you a whole lot of money. So paying a significant amount in premiums for either collision or comp doesn't make much sense. Liability coverage, uninsured and underinsured, those are very important coverages because the liability coverage essentially protects you in the event you're in an accident. And as careful as you are, for some reason, you could be at fault for the accident. That collision protects liability coverage protects you against claims from other people. Uninsured protects you when somebody who doesn't have insurance hits you. Even though we're a mandatory insurance state, believe me, there are plenty of people out there who don't buy insurance. And underinsured, which, you know, I'm going to touch on just real briefly because I think it's very important. Underinsured protects you when somebody hits you and they have not enough coverage to pay for the injury you receive. And we're now, our limits are $25,000 per person. That's the minimum. And we see emergency room visits that cost $25,000. Yeah. So if somebody hits you and injures you significantly, they can easily have insurance but not have nearly enough to compensate you for your injury. That's what underinsured motorist coverage does. That coverage should never be, in my mind, lower than your liability limits. And we do see some companies doing that where they're writing lower underinsured motorist limits, which effectively means if you're buying liability coverage for, say, $250, $500, or $100, $300, you certainly shouldn't have less underinsured motorist coverage than that because then you're protecting other people, you know, more than you're protecting yourself, in a sense. So that's the quick answer.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Jerry, does that help out?
It helps out a lot, you know. Again, the coverage we recommend, for instance, for liabilities, $250.
I think 250, 500 is a good idea. It doesn't cost that much to go from 100, 300, or for that matter, to from 50, 100 to that. And again, we're living in an era where we see medical bills and claims that exceed $100,000 quite regularly. And if that's the case, then the whole claim can have a value of $200,000, $300,000 or even more. So 250 is a good limit. And you should also consider an umbrella beyond that, because umbrella policies, if you've got that underlying coverage, are really not very expensive. You know, the risk of needing that is not very great, but the cost isn't very great either. You know, it's like your home. I mean, your home's probably not going to burn down, but we still insure it.
Yeah, absolutely. Jerry, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary emailed in, and by the way, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails again, Mary emailed to say she was one of four cars struck by a large passenger truck. And she's wondering about explaining the or estimating pain and suffering suffering amount based on the amount of medical expenses incurred. Is this a good way to estimate a settlement for pain and suffering? She had some soft tissue injuries, which amount, you know, does she use, you know, the full amount of the medical bill, some adjusted balance? What goes on there?
Well, you know, traditionally, and Guy's done a lot of this work too, and there's always been this thought that, you know, is it three times the specials or is it two times the specials? And a lot of people think that number's gone down, not up over the years. In reality, it isn't a great measure for a lot of reasons. They really are two separate things. Do juries pay some attention to that if you try cases, which almost never happens anymore?
Yeah,
they pay some attention, and companies certainly do. When companies look at that, a big part of what they do is they look at the specials and they say, and the specials are the medical expense and any lost wages. And they say, okay, the jury, we're at fault. Jury's going to give them that. What else are they going to give them? And generally, they're going to at least match that. We certainly do better than that in the vast majority of cases. The fact is, it's not always a very good test. You could, let's say you lost an arm, and, you know, there really isn't a lot of medical treatment for that. It's a terrible thing to have happen, but there's not a lot of medical treatment. You'd have an expense for a prosthetic and things like that. But the actual damages could be many multiples of the medical bills themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are cases where you have very high medical bills. One of the things that happens now is people go into an ER, and if they've had potentially a head injury, a neck injury, you may get CAT scans run, MRIs run, and again, you can have an ER bill that's $20,000 plus, and yet, you know, you might have a very good recovery from that. And in that case, you know, the medicals, again, may overestimate. Just trying to multiply the medicals may not give you a fair number either. So, you know, honestly, I think that's one of the reasons you hire a lawyer if you have a, if you have a significant claim. If it's a relatively minor claim, you know what? Call a lawyer in your area. Call a personal injury guy. I talk to people all the time. We're happy to give people advice. It's always best to have somebody who has a little better feel for that kind of thing in a given case rather than simply trying to multiply things in your head.
Talking today with Mike Riley and Guy DeBow from the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have them with us. Taking a look at a lot of things relating to Wisconsin law, we've been talking mostly so far about auto insurance and claims and a little bit about health care issues relating to insurance with our two guests, Mike Riley and Guy DeBow of the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have them with us today. And a number of callers online. I did want to bring up the marijuana laws before we go too much further here. Where does Wisconsin stand right now on the laws? I'm certainly seeing lots of advertising on television now about CBD oil as an example.
Well, exactly. And CBD, just to be clear, is not medical marijuana. It is a product that is derived from hemp plants primarily, at least the most of the legal versions are. It is possible to drive it directly from a marijuana plant, but you're not seeing a whole lot of that entering the state. At least people hope not. And the psychoactive ingredient, the CBD oil that you see, that is the what produces the high in marijuana, most of that has been taken out. Right now, you know, the law is depends a lot on who you ask.
Yeah.
Exactly what is going on with CBD, but it is under most interpretations a product that people can have and can have legally. Our attorney general has issued a statement telling local law enforcement not to necessarily prosecute sales of CBD. Technically, the law is such that if you have a doctor's certification for it and you buy it from a particular type of pharmacy that has certain licensures for it, then you can't be arrested.
Okay.
That's not the same as saying that it's necessarily legal or that it's illegal if you don't get it from those sources. So
so it's a little up in the air kind of in a way.
To say that this is confused is perhaps an understatement. And it you can actually look at the federal laws on it. And I could point you to two different laws that are in direct conflict with one another on this. And it asks, you know, whether or not you're looking at the drug enforcement laws or whether you're looking at the farm bill. So it sort of depends on the interpretation that you're dealing with.
Well, apparently you can't be arrested for advertising the sale of it, for sure, because we're seeing a lot of it on at least local television in Madison, I expect, in other places as well.
Oh, sure, sure. And it's becoming a fairly ubiquitous product. Now, you know, obviously marijuana itself, despite the fact that it was on a recent number of ballot initiatives across the state, it remains illegal in this state and certainly illegal under federal laws as well, too.
And that applies even to medical marijuana. You can't get a prescription and get marijuana.
That's correct. Not in the state legally anyway. Yeah. So.
All right. There we go. Well, we have a number of callers. Mike in Augusta has a question for you. So let's go there. Mike, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an auto insurance question for you.
Okay.
I've got two kids in college, age 18 and 21, and they are still on my auto insurance, which costs quite a bit. Even though they only come home just a handful of times a year and may or may not drive when they're home. I understand my policy covers me if someone borrows my car to drive it. Can I drop their permanent coverage and just cover them under that issue if they happen to borrow the car when they're home?
Well, they almost certainly remain members of your household, which remain, you know, whether they're named in the policy or not, they're going to be insured under the policy because they are members of your household. I'm not sure that's going to change your rating, but I'd talk to your agent and ask him, say, you know, the kids aren't here, they're there. Do we have to name them specifically? I'm assuming they don't have their own vehicles. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I did talk to my agent about it. They just said it's best to have them on, but you know, they're going to say that. It would cost quite a bit. It does cost quite a bit more to keep them on the policy. As a matter of fact, we got rid of one of the vehicles when they went away to college, and my policy barely changed because they said it's the drivers, not the vehicles, that keep the
Well, and it should change because obviously when you took out the coverage, the kids were at home and were driving your vehicles on a regular basis, which is why, you know, your rates are higher because obviously they're much higher for young drivers. But again, almost every policy I've ever seen, and again, guys familiar with this can comment, but a child who's a member of your household is going to be an insured. And the case law is fairly clear that simply because somebody is going to college somewhere else but retains your home as their permanent home address and plans to return there, they almost certainly qualify as a member of the household. If you want to send me the language from your policy, you can give me a call and I'll take a look at it for you and tell you what it says. There are some variations on the language, but generally speaking, they're members of the household, and members of the household are covered under your policy, whether or not they're named insureds.
Well, that's correct. The experience that I have, and this was with actually one son recently going to college, is exactly that. We talked to our agent about that, and when he was gone, the price dropped without a doubt, and he was able to be taken off the coverage. The benchmark that my agent used was the number of cars that were being insured. We have multiple kids. So as long as there was at least one person attached to every vehicle, then that was fine. The others could just be his riders. There was a bit of a question when he would come home, at least during the first couple of years of college, when he would come home over summer break as to whether or not we had to reinstate that coverage or not,
but it could be reinstated at that time.
Yeah, and just on a short-term basis is what we did.
And it's always better to be safe than sorry, but I mean, generally speaking, policy language says that if somebody is a member of the household by blood or marriage, then they are covered whether or not they're named insured. And he obviously, you do remain a member of the household, even if you're at college, in the military, generally speaking. There are a whole bunch of different tests. Do they get their mail at your house? Is their driver's license still use your house? It's the range. But certainly college kids are going to be members of the household.
There you go, Mike. Thanks so much for calling. We'll turn to Tom in Madison next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Sure. First, a shout out to the other listeners. I am a sustainer, and it feels great.
Thank you.
Certainly. I wanted to find out. I recently had some hail damage to my car, and in working with my insurance company, I wasn't sure what shop I wanted to get the repair done at and so forth. And I'd asked them, can I just take the amount of cover, the covered amount, and in a check made out to me? And the answer was no, if it's over $1,500, that it has to be made out to me and the shop. And I'm curious as to why that is. Mm-hmm. And why, and if there's any way that can be averted.
I don't know why that is, because I don't think there's any requirement. If the policy doesn't set forth a specific requirement, I don't think you have to do that. I mean, if the policy says they will pay for the damage, then they should pay for the damage. The only interest I can imagine a company having in that is that if they somehow are concerned about salvage value, but that's honestly so remote. I'd ask them to point to you in the policy where that requirement exists, because if it doesn't, then they should pay you.
Yeah. I had hail damage to my car. This is several years back, but I just got a check for it and went to my shop and got it fixed.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything legally that says that's true. And so then they'd have to show you where in the policy they can pay you and the shop, as opposed to just paying you if that's what you request. And I doubt they're going to be able to point to anything.
There you go. Thank you so much, Tom, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. On to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. I also am a sustainer and a legacy donor.
Thank you.
I'm going to give another donation today, just because I'll probably get that in free legal advice. So I look forward to that. This may be a little outside of the practice area, but I think it's a practical suggestion. How can you maintain your rights in a traffic stop, not submit to searches, and remain silent without becoming confrontational and having a confrontational situation where the officer starts retaliating or becoming unnecessarily harsh in the way they respond? Can you stand up for your rights without it being confrontational with an officer?
You certainly can. And, you know, it's always well to bear in mind, whether you're in a car or anywhere else, cooperating, you know, in a general sense is always the better course. Joseph Wambach, I know, used to write novels about the police in L.A., and his point was always is the worst crime you can commit is contempt of cop. And, you know, if you want to set up a dynamic that is not good, you know, all you have to do is be defiant, disrespectful, no matter how frustrating it is, and it is at sometimes. You're always better off. They have a right to see your license, show them the license. You know, if you ask questions, I mean, if it's a rational question, and it's not inappropriate, that's fine. I think it's highly unusual in the course of a traffic stop for officers to institute a search. In Madison anymore, there are no traffic stops pretty much. So it's really not a big problem here anymore because they're too busy doing other things. But, you know, if you do get stopped, you know, they have to have a reasonable basis to suspect there's some crime being committed other than the fact that you're driving your car. And just driving your car doesn't make you give them carte blanche rights to just search the car. If they suggest they want to, you know, the simple question is why? I mean, what is it, officer, that you believe makes me suspicious, that you think there's something going on wrong here other than maybe I was going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit or whatever it might be? But generally speaking, you know, it's certainly fine to, you know, ask questions if they're appropriate, but getting into a situation where it's headbutting, you know, in that situation, it's like headbutting contest with a ram. You know, they have the power. They have a lot more they can do to you than you can do to them, and it's much better to be as cooperative as you can within limits rather than trying to confront an officer at that point. You're much better off to, if you feel they're being inappropriate, file a complaint later, complain to the department, do whatever you need to do. But again, getting into a confrontational situation with a policeman hardly ever pays.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike Riley and Guy DeBow, our guests today, partners in the Exley Law Firm. Great to have them with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk Wisconsin law. We're giving you some updates. We've talked about a lot about insurance and insurance coverages, auto insurance. We've talked medical marijuana, some of the laws surrounding that with our two guests today, Mike Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, Guy DeBow, a healthcare attorney and also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Questions for them, hey, we can get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. The first time I was introduced to roundabouts was in 1985 when I went to Trinidad and Tobago for a year. Trinidad and Tobago has, I think, the highest per capita auto accident rate in the world. And they were all used to using roundabouts, and I was not. So it took a little getting used to, but it's, for me, it's nice to see them here. But what are the laws surrounding roundabouts, Mike Riley?
Yeah, I thought the segue into that was interesting. They have the highest accident rate per capita in the world, but you think roundabouts are a great idea? Well, you know, roundabouts are a relatively recent phenomenon. I encountered them in England some years ago. And, you know, the problem we've had starting out, at least, is people still, and I think still, people aren't really terribly used to them here.
Yeah.
And it takes some getting used to. You know, the Brits do it flawlessly. Sounds like Trinidad and Tobago does it less flawlessly, but, you know, but people are used to
it. They do it fast, I can tell you that.
Well, that's good for lawyers. I'm not sure it's good for anyone else. The roundabouts are, you know, the problems I see here really are they're not signed very well. They often have, you know, they have all this combination of arrows within the roundabout that always look like snakes mating, you know, they're just, you know, the sinuous back and forth. And so, you know, the problems you have is people within the roundabout have a right of way. And of course, people who are not in are always kind of waiting with bated breath to get in and darting out. And people often don't know whether they should signal or not signal or what they should do. And so I think that they are confusing. Well, our legislature has added significantly to that not too long ago, passing a law that, frankly, is just classic special interest, you know, legislation that really doesn't serve the interest of the public very well at all. What happened is a trucking firm had an accident within the roundabout. Semi-trucks are not designed for roundabouts very well, you know, because they're really big, their turning radius isn't good, and they tend to take up an awful lot of room. And so a semi ran into somebody in a roundabout, damaged their car. And as has happened a lot in the last 6 to 8 years in this state, you know, somebody raced to his legislator, said, gee, this is terrible. Why should I have to pay for this? And they immediately had a law in the hopper and it was passed, you know, very quickly. And what the law says, and shockingly, and this is what I do for a living, I didn't know about this till we finally got a case involving it. There now is a law that says in a roundabout, a truck 40 feet more in length, 10 feet in width, which is a semi, if you're entering a roundabout at or about the same time as the truck, then essentially they have complete right of way. You're supposed to evidently slam on your brakes, you know, lest they run over you and crush you, which is what happened to my client in the case that we now have. And so in that case, to add to it, it's out by Cottage Grove. The lane that the trucker is in, the right-hand lane, is actually signed as a through lane. And those arrows, unlike many, are pretty straightforward. I mean, they show that if you're in that lane, you're supposed to go around and then take that next turn. The inside lane is if you're going to round past more than one exit. And that's very clearly marked. Well, in this case, the trucker halfway through decided he was going to make the turn and did and essentially ran over our vehicle. And the local police department, influenced by a state patrol officer on the scene, decided that it must be my gal's fault because they were in a roundabout and this was a truck. There actually is another law, which they ignored entirely, and that law says that if there are lanes within a roundabout, some don't have marked lanes, but many do. If there are lanes, then it says, well, the truck can deviate, but only with due regard for other traffic. Now, the general law, the new law they passed, they did pass them in concert. So in my view, it's fairly clear that the law that says they can only do it with due regard applies if there are lanes. But it's very clear that truckers are being told by their bosses that it's just fine for them to deviate from one lane to another and that they have the right of way when they're doing it. And, you know, it's really a motorist beware, because you have to know that there are truckers out there who insist on this and think they have that right. I don't think they do under a lot of circumstances, but both the truckers and, frankly, the police aren't very well versed in what the law actually says. It's a terrible law. It's a dangerous law because it encourages truckers to just kind of do whatever they want within a roundabout.
So, in other words, use some caution when you're in your car, well, or if you're in your semi, too, for that matter.
You should. I mean, if you're in your semi, you should do what any sensible person would do is with due regard for traffic. You'd make sure there isn't somebody there that you're going to run over. In our case, the guy went all the way over, literally onto the center of the median, and ran over our car in the process. But people just need to be aware that that law is out there and that, you know, one, whether it's laned or not, you should be aware that truckers, I think, are fairly well versed in this now, and certainly the police think they are. And it just creates a real hazard, both in terms of injury and in terms of perhaps, you know, the legal situation. So people need to know about that.
Let's go to Joe in Madison next with a question. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I had a question regarding this tree that fell on my car a few years back while I was renting a room at a house, and I was curious what kind of work I would need to do before I actually filed a lawsuit to try to claim some of that money, or I guess make sure that the property owner actually follows through with their agreement to reimburse me. The tree had some sort of disease, and I was wondering, I guess, if I needed to get an expert opinion about whether or not they thought that the tree needs to be taken down beforehand, like if it was a hazard or not.
So, so if a tree, in this case, in Joe's case, the tree fell on his car, is the owner of the tree liable on this, or what's the deal?
Well, it really does depend. I mean, Joe's point about the disease is pretty critical, because the owner would have to be negligent. It's not absolute liability. It isn't because something happens on your property you're responsible. We actually had a terrible case a few years back where a tree fell that was on city property, fell on top of a car, somebody was driving, and the person driving was killed. But liability, legal responsibility for that depends on whether there was enough forewarning so that a reasonable person would have said, gosh, I should take that tree down because it presents a hazard to other people. The first thing I think Joe talked about, an agreement. I mean, if you can get an agreement with the owner to do it, that's always the best solution. I mean, talk to him, see if you can do that. If that isn't going to work, or if the owner is now reneging on the commitment, then the thing would probably be to file a small claims action. There are financial limits. It's generally $5,000 if there's insurance, and can be up to $10,000. But you'd need to look at that. That's if your car is worth a lot more than that, then obviously you can't do that. But small claims is a very streamlined process. It's something you can do yourself, and it's a much better solution generally than filing a lawsuit, if you can come within the financial constraints.
There you go. Thank you so much, Joe, for that question. Appreciate your call. And Sue in Platteville, do you have a question?
I do. I am currently a organic farmer in Grant County, primarily orchard and small berries and fruits. But I'm looking towards the time when marijuana is legal to grow and in our state. And how should I be preparing for that if I want to legally grow marijuana once it's legal?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's a great question, Sue. And I wish I had a nice, clear answer for you. One of the things that a lot of folks are doing right now, I think I mentioned earlier, there's a pilot program being run by the Ag Department for growing hemp. And I know a lot of folks are getting into that space because that will give them some basic understanding of, you know, what this product is like. It hooks them into networks that are dealing with processing and distribution of this as a product. Now, I've also talked to a number of farmers that are very reluctant to do that. One of the things that people have found out in states where marijuana is legal is that hemp and marijuana as agricultural products don't really play that well together. And as a matter of fact, in a lot of growing environments, and even some states it's required, that marijuana be grown indoors. And one of the reasons for that is because a hemp field within 20 miles can cross-pollinate it. So it can cause that problem. You know, there's legislation in the hopper right now that is, you know, folks are looking at that is going to set up a producing network. So things like that.
And we can talk some more about that as the program grows along. Thank you so much, Sue, for talking with us today. Taking a look at legal issues on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Mike Riley, back with us once again. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. He's a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Guy DeBoe with us as well, a healthcare attorney, also a partner in the Axley Law Firm. He's been looking into the medical marijuana laws and certainly has the ability to answer your questions in that area as well. I hope you'll join in with your legal questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and all the lines are open, so we'll get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. And Guy DeBoe, I want to go back to the lady, the woman who was a farmer and interested in marijuana and possibly getting into that and wondering how to prepare.
Right, yeah, and I wanted to circle back to what Sue was asking about. Obviously, I don't want to get in the way of the important work you and Keeley were doing there, but right now there is a program that is being administered for the growing of hemp, and a lot of people, as I was saying, are interested in that. Now, folks need to be aware that there are deadlines that pen to that and work that needs to be done in order to be to obtain a license to do that. And folks are being licensed both as producers, in other words, the farmers who are actually growing the hemp, as well as processors. And these are the folks that are going to be taking industrial hemp and working that into both CBD oils as well as a wide variety of industrial products. And, you know, there's, like I say, there's a number of steps to that. I'm certainly happy to explore those with people.
So I can't imagine that there, well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say, I can't imagine there are a lot of attorneys who have looked into this so too much as of yet, but there are probably many out there yet.
Well, I don't know that we are working in that space. Our firm has actually developed a cannabis team that has seven different attorneys, each with a different background, you know, mine being healthcare policy, things along those lines. We have business attorneys, we have litigators, we have real estate specialists, because all these different things are impacted by the way those laws are going to change, and we have folks who are working very closely to monitor what is going on out on the legislative front. I get this service that I subscribe to that tracks different legalization and related issues. Right now, there are, I think, as of this morning, 963 bills pending in various state courthouses and before Congress that impact the marijuana and cannabis and hemp industries in one form or another. So there's a lot of stuff going on out there, and you know, Wisconsin is, you know, I don't think it's a matter of if, I think it's a matter of when all these things are coming here.
Well, let's go back to the phones and take some calls, and we can talk about hemp, or we can talk about other things as well. I think Ron in Spring Green has a different question, so let's go to Ron. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, by the way. I had an issue at work a while ago. I injured my shoulder, just like everybody else, ought to go away. So it didn't go away, so I went and seen a doctor, and they did an MRI and found I have any muscle separated from the shoulder, and through a few doctor visits and the workman's comp getting involved, they are treating it as the arthritic spur is worn out, so it's an age issue, not a work injury. So they're failing to stand behind this. And I was just going to get your take to see what steps I should take.
To look into this further, yeah.
Well, you should probably consult with a lawyer who does workers' comp. I don't do workers' comp, but the issues are very familiar. Insurance companies have a stable of doctors who will frankly say pretty much anything they want them to say. And that's a shame, but it's true. And there are a lot of reasons for that. We don't need to go into them. That's the reality. So it's pretty standard operating procedure. When there's anything they can question, they'll go get their doctor, who will routinely say, oh, no, this isn't really a work-related injury. It's something that's been there. Now, the question is, maybe that spur has been there. There's not much doubt. A spur doesn't just develop overnight. But if that the work aggravates that and makes it symptomatic, so you have to seek treatment for it, that should still be covered under workers' compensation. If you get a lawyer involved, a lawyer can get an objective doctor. First thing is that if your treater says this really is caused by the injury, by work injury, or is related to a work injury because it's an aggravation caused by work of an underlying condition, that should be covered. So the first step is to get something from your own doctor confirming that. If he does that, then, and if they still don't pay any attention, and they may not, I'd consult with a lawyer who does workers' comp. There are plenty of them that do that. And, see if they can't help with that, because I can tell you from long experience that ultimately it goes to a hearing. The company may or may not be willing to push it to a hearing, because when you go into a hearing in front of, a judge advocate, and the judges listen to this, and there are specific judges that handle these, if they listen to this and you've got a treater who says this is related to your work, and you have a hired gun, and they generally know who the hired guns are because they see them on a regular basis, they're not terribly likely to give the opinion from the hired gun precedence over an opinion from your treating physician. But I think probably you need to get a lawyer involved at this point.
All right. Ron, thank you so much for calling. Peter in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hello. My question is, I was T-boned, shattered my left forearm, some additional injuries from the seatbelt and stuff, but their initial offer for pain and suffering was $6,000. Can you make an estimate about what they might be willing to go up to based on their initial offer?
That's just not something I can do in this context, Peter. I mean, if you want to give me a call, off the air, I'd be happy to talk to you. It's just, there's so much involved in that, and Guy's done tons of it, and he'd say the same thing. You just can't, based on that little snapshot, I can't give you advice. I can tell you this and tell everybody else this. First offer a company makes in an injury claim is almost never the last offer they're going to make. And it's also true that in this day and age, there used to be a time when companies, frankly, in my view, had a greater interest in trying to do the right thing. We're in an age of computers where everybody gets their orders from the computer that doesn't know a darn thing about who you are, how this has affected your life. And when you get into these situations, if you have a minor injury, you can often negotiate that on your own. If you get something more serious like this, you're probably not well served to try to do it. It's not what you do for a living. You don't know you don't know the territory, as they said in The Music Man. He doesn't know the territory. Well, it's like anything else. I don't know how to fix a car, and I'd be pretty silly to try. And if you have a significant injury where there's real money, and it sounds like this might well be that, you really probably should talk to a lawyer, because that's not something you likely should do on your own. Is their first offer their last? Almost certainly not. Will you get to a number with them that's fair? I'm highly skeptical that will happen, but, you can certainly give it a shot.
There you go. Good luck, Peter. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Tess in Lodi next. Hi, Tess. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about being rear-ended in a roundabout, if that's an appropriate question.
Yeah.
Sure.
Great. It was a strange accident. I pulled into the outside lane of a roundabout, and I'd given space for the person behind me who was already in the roundabout. But the woman on the inside lane of the roundabout didn't think I had. I'm still upset at her. She honked at me. And when she honked at me, I thought she was going to pull in front of me. I thought she had the right of way. She was planning to exit and run into me, basically. So I slowed down and stopped, which, obviously, you don't want to do in a roundabout. And when I did that, the car that was behind me, whom I thought had time to stop, I didn't realize that they were a large work truck pulling a heavy trailer, and they rear-ended me pretty severely. So that's what happened. The police came, interviewed them first, told me to go stand aside while he talked to both of them together. They both told him that I had failed to give way to the truck behind me, and that's what caused the accident. And when I talked to him, he was ticketing me for that. And I said, that's not what happened. I actually stopped because I thought someone was going to run into me from the side. And when I stopped, he rear-ended me, which, you know, may have been partly my fault, but also didn't he have some liability for failure to control his vehicle? And the police officer had already let the guy go at that point. So he changed his ticket for me to stopping in an intersection. My insurance company paid for the whole accident for damage to my vehicle and theirs. But when I randomly talked to someone from my insurance company a few months later, they said they'd never heard of someone being liable for being rear-ended unless they were actually backing up when it occurred. What do you make of this?
Well, it's certainly true that for the most part, you know, you're not going to be responsible when you're rear-ended. I mean, you can't drive down the road and suddenly out of frustration or whatever, slam on your brakes and have the person hit you and then claim it's their fault. You know, that would be your fault. In this case, there was a rational basis for your stopping. Now, Wisconsin's a comparative negligence state, which says that we don't just say, okay, you know, that's it, it's all your fault, it's not no fault at all on the other person. Question becomes, you know, where does the preponderance of the responsibility lie? If they're more responsible than you are, then they should be paying. You shouldn't be. You would deduct your percentage of responsibility. Let's say it's 60-40, that they're 60 at fault and you're 40 at fault. Then they, you know, you would recover, but you'd get 40% less than your damages. That's the way comparative negligence works. You know, again, you have to look at the whole situation, and it's always tough in this context to give advice about a specific fact situation. I don't think that it's an automatic at all, and unfortunately, this have now gotten the insurance industry mad and will now get the police departments mad too. Police officers do a terrible job of investigating accidents a fair share of the time, it's fair to say. I don't think and insurance companies tend to look at police reports and put a great deal of reliance on them when I don't think they should in a lot of cases. In the roundabout case I was talking about, they blame Iwan when I think she clearly is not at fault, and I think we'll prove that in the end. You know, I think you could talk to a lawyer and talk to him specifically about your case. It's a fairly close call in my mind, because somebody is going to argue, well, you're in a roundabout. The whole idea in a roundabout is you don't stop, you know, you keep going, and you did, you know, but there was a reason why you did that. So I don't know, Guy, you've done tons of this stuff. What do you think?
Well, I will confess to having not done tons of roundabout cases. No, I would echo pretty much what Mike has said there, that, you know, this is kind of a close call. There is a certain expectation when you're driving in a roundabout that's probably a little different than the expectation that exists when you're driving down the road or when you're going through a normal four-way intersection. So I don't know. I would be inclined to give you the same advice that Mike has. Really sit down with somebody, take the time to go through the facts, and, you know, if this is something that you're interested in pursuing, it's not going to make the ticket go away. But if you had sustained some sort of injury or have damages there, it's entirely possible that some of that could be attributed to the other driver that you could recover for.
Barb, thank you again for calling, Tess. Appreciate it. Barb from St. Germain wonders if umbrella policies for auto insurance are worth it.
I think they're absolutely worth it. Obviously, you have to have something to protect. That's the whole idea of insurance, is that you have assets that somebody's able to get at, so that if they were injured so severely that, you know, your underlying insurance coverage didn't satisfy them, you'd have an umbrella over and above that. Umbrellas really are very inexpensive, and you might be able, and you should talk to your agent, but you might be able to drop the amount of your underlying coverage, which is a lot more expensive, you know, your basic policy with your 100, 300 liability or 250, 500. Talk to your agent and see what they can tell you about the relative costs and whether you couldn't get yourself more coverage without maybe paying anything more, or perhaps paying less. But they're certainly worth considering if you have significant assets that somebody could get at if you were unfortunately in an accident that you might be responsible for and somebody was badly injured.
Makes good sense to me. Mike Riley and Guy DeBoe, our guests today. Mike, a third-generation Madison attorney, and he's done a lot of work on this program. He comes by every so often to talk with us. Guy DeBoe, a partner with Mike in the Axley Law Firm of Madison, A-X-L-E-Y, Axley Law Firm of Madison. Always great to have them with us.